individual, the personal lives of people in Palestine, it's quite striking. Even then, when you look at, and there have been some good stories, some empathetic stories about individuals, families in Palestine, it is what Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky have described as victims without victimizers. So the indirection is what's conveyed in terms of Israeli culpability. Yes, Israel clearly drops the bombs. U.S. media coverage is sometimes critical of them doing it, but the benefit of the doubt is often given, routinely given, that, well, it's not that they're intentionally killing the Palestinian civilians, but they're being really careless. They're engaged in disregard and being sloppy about it, not really taking the kind of care that they should. And even less culpability is ascribed to Washington. And it's really talked about in U.S. media that this slaughter going on in Gaza would be really impossible without the U.S. arms shipments and the pipeline that continues. And I've thought a lot about the continuity of propaganda assumptions, which are often the most pernicious. And I could mention just a few really quickly, where the pattern set after 9/11 with the so-called war on terror have really been very entrenched in terms of U.S. media and politics with what Israel is doing in Gaza and how the media and political power structures in the United States really evade, elide, dodge the U.S. role in what really is a genocide. For instance, the mainstream discourse really avoids voices that condemn the U.S. government for its role. The U.S. allies usually just bypass accountability for the high-tech atrocities committed from the air. And that's a key point, because somehow we're acculturated. If the U.S. or U.S. ally kills people from high in the air, you know, we're above it all. It's maybe unfortunate mistakes are made. It can be criticized, but it's not really crude and barbarian like those who don't have high-tech missiles to inflict their atrocities, usually, frankly, on a smaller scale than what the high-tech Israeli military or U.S. military are doing. And the civilian deaths in Gaza are just portrayed as unintended, which again is really emblematic of how the U.S. media have portrayed the killing that the U.S. government has been engaged in ever since October 2001 with the invasion of Afghanistan, and sometimes not visible to U.S. media at all, the ongoing war on terror that continues to this day.
You're listening to Norman Solomon on War and the Media. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. Israel has banned journalists from Gaza. Al Jazeera has been banned from reporting altogether from Israel and the occupied territories. Where are the words of protest from the icons of the liberal press, such as David Ignatius, Thomas Friedman, David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, and others? Where is CNN's Wolf Blitzer, who has a daily Situation Room program on CNN? And by the way, he once worked for AIPAC. Or Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic and host of PBS's Washington Week, who actually served in the Israeli army.
Yeah, the double standard is just so extreme, where when some enemy state imprisons or kills journalists, there are howls of outrage from U.S. mainstream media, as there should be. But we don't hear anywhere near that kind of outrage when, in the case of Israel, well documented, the Israeli government intentionally targets and kills journalists. And that has been really in play in Gaza, where well over 100 journalists have been killed by Israel since October 7, 2023. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, based in New York, which is very much a mainstream institution, has said point blank that Israel has been killing journalists intentionally. And when you think about it, when crimes are being committed by the Israeli government, of course the Israeli government wants to close the eyes of the world. That could document, could portray, could convey what's really going on.
Talk more about war and the media. And I'm thinking of the robotic mantra that is repeated endlessly. The war started on October 7th. Most recently, I've heard it on Morning Edition from National Public Radio. Andrea Mitchell, being interviewed by Dana Bash on CNN, said the same thing. The war started on October 7th. So there's no history. There's no context. There's no background.
History begins when we say it began. That's really the underlying precept. We get to say when meaningful events started. And in this case, when 700,000 Palestinian people were expelled from their homes, from their villages, from their homeland in 1948 with the creation of Israel, that doesn't count. When the occupation, illegal since 1967, has gone on in the West Bank, in Gaza, that doesn't count. When the infliction of all kinds of humiliations and violence on Palestinians of all ages in Gaza and West Bank, that doesn't count. And on. So these events are simply faded into the scenery. They don't get registered in the measurements that we are told really matter. And then when a crime is committed against Israelis, as horribly happened on October 7th, then this is the starting point, we're told. It all began here. And that's just ridiculous. That's not how history happens. That's not how individual lives happen, let alone the lives of individual societies and governments and so forth. So it's a propaganda technique that sort of, so to speak, waves the bloody shirt. It focuses empathy at certain points. The rhetoric of the time, this is an inflection point. How is the inflection point defined? It's defined the way those in power use it. And I go back to the use of words, which is really very important. George Orwell said that words, manipulative words, they don't cause us to have sloppy and erroneous thoughts, but they make it easier. And going back to how the major media outlets, as we cited statistically, using the word slaughter 60-1 to say that Israeli lives matter so much more than Palestinian lives, it reminds me of something. And David, I sometimes think even more than any other ideology, it is Lewis Carrollism that I think is a useful way to evaluate media and politics. In the book Through the Looking Glass, Alice is talking to Humpty Dumpty, and she gets so frustrated by the bluster and double talk from Humpty that she says, the question is, how can you make one word mean so many different things? And Humpty Dumpty replies, the question is, who has the power? That's all.
The hostages that were taken on October 7th have certainly been the focus of a lot of the media coverage. You rarely hear anything about the 11,000 Palestinians being held without charge, some being tortured, sexually abused, and humiliated. I'm not saying that those hostages that Hamas took, should be ignored. Of course not. They should be released and freed. But to not talk about this huge number, 11,000 Palestinians in jails and prisons under terrible conditions, that gets that proverbial free pass again from the media.
That goes to the crying need for a single standard of human rights. And it's right in front of us. You know, on the surface, as we talk about it, it might sound like, oh, that's easy, just have the same yardstick. In practice, it's very difficult because of the crosswinds of biases, of ethnocentric spin, of nationalism, of conscious or unconscious religious chauvinism. And so it has made it easier with these kind of biases for news media and politicians to just ignore that silence is such a powerful form of propaganda. And it goes to how words are used. What is a hostage? What is a political prisoner? What is torture? By not acknowledging that Israel has a long and accelerating history of torture of thousands and thousands of Palestinians, somehow it's like the precept that's awful but reigning in Washington: appearance is reality. Silence is therefore not a reality, according to that sort of de facto Orwellian system. I think too of words like terrorism and mass media. The media coverage, the political rhetoric in the United States in describing what is going on in Gaza, it's all really stayed away from acknowledging that with a single standard, we could call Israel's actions mass murder. We could call it terrorism. And it's notable that just a few weeks ago, the former CIA and defense secretary, uppercase defense secretary, Leon Panetta, said on a CBS interview that unequivocally, what Israel did with its pager attack in Lebanon was terrorism. He used the word point blank and didn't walk away from it. And that's simply antithetical to U.S. news media, because whether in that instance or the entire war on civilians in Gaza, the unspoken rule has been that you absolutely do not call the Israeli government terrorist. And yet, I think from a single standard, Israel is a terrorist government. It continues to terrorize civilians, 2.2 million of them in Gaza, and is now also terrorizing people in Lebanon.
Well, with all the attention on Gaza and Lebanon, under the radar is what's happening on the West Bank, where now Palestinian deaths exceed 700, some of it caused by the Israeli military and some by so-called settlers who kill, maim, and destroy property. They cut down olive trees and burn crop fields, while in some cases the Israeli military is just watching. Now, speaking of language and the vocabulary that we use, would you find it appropriate that settlers should be called colonists and that settlements are in fact colonies?
There's huge documentation, including in Rashid Khalidi's book, The Hundred Years War on Palestine, that the founders of Israel, and even before Israel was founded, they very frankly, in a lot of their statements, referred to what they wanted was a process of colonization. They knew what they were doing. And despite the mythology and the sloganeering that Israel was going to be for people without land, a place where there were no people in the land, there was conscious awareness by the Zionist leadership that people did live in Palestine and that they would need to be colonized or evicted. There were public claims, I think it was Golda Meir, that Palestinians didn't really exist, and talk about invisibility. I mean, this is, you know, a certain kind of an ultimate arrogance. And so when settlers more and more have been brought in the last few decades, often from the United States, they've been glorified. It's that whole mythology, you know, going back to Paul Newman and the Exodus film in the early 1960s and so forth, that these wonderful people are coming in. They're refugees from anti-Semitism and, of course, from the Holocaust. And so they become these modern-day pioneers who are seen and portrayed as really scratching out of the desert this blooming paradise because of their hard work and their ethic and their spirituality and the rest of it.
Given the magnitude and scale of death and destruction going on in the Middle East, how can we look away? Are we good Germans? I'm reminded of the German Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was part of the anti-Nazi resistance, who was hanged in a concentration camp. He said, I'm quoting, "Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act."
I think it was Bonhoeffer who wrote that to resist repression, to resist evil, if you will, we need community. And I think that's profoundly the case. And in the context of the Middle East, as Americans, we know or should know that the U.S. diplomatic power, military power, and the U.S. Treasury are all supporting genocide through the Israeli government. And we need to name that. We need to acknowledge it. And it's necessary to work with others with a sense of community to organize, because that's really where the change is going to happen. I'm really proud that my colleagues at rootsaction.org are organizing something called Teach-In Network. And we are planning for widespread teach-ins around the country, particularly on college campuses where repression has come down more and more, planning over the summer. Now we're in the middle of the autumn, and many college administrators are fed up with the use of the First Amendment. They don't want encampments. They don't want protests. They don't want their students actually trying to affect history in the present. They want them just to study history in the past, like a museum, like looking at paintings on the wall. And we have, I think, an opportunity, including through the Teach-In Network, which, by the way, is teachinnetwork.org, to say, no, we will engage in thought crimes if it's a thought crime to have solidarity with Palestinian people.
Another mantra that is frequently heard is that Israel has a right to defend itself. How would you respond to that?
Israel does have a right to defend itself. It does not have a right to slaughter children, women, and other civilians on a massive scale in Gaza. It doesn't have a right to engage in ethnic cleansing in Gaza and the West Bank. It doesn't have the right to continue to impose apartheid on Arab citizens inside Israel, as well as those in occupied territories. Israel also does not have a right to endanger the lives of hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East and beyond with this really unhinged militarism. We've seen Israel as the one country in the Middle East that claims for itself and implements for itself the prerogative to bomb and invade one country after another. We've seen that in terms of Israel's attacks on not only Gaza, but on Lebanon, on Syria, on Iran. And it's a attitude that says, we've got the power and might makes right. And they have the power and they have the might largely because of the U.S. government. So this claim, and this has been frankly disgusting coming from the White House, that Uncle Sam is just like a fly on the wall watching what Benjamin Netanyahu does, it's absurd. We have this power as Americans, if we have a democracy, which is not particularly borne out by actual dynamics, but to exert democratic power from the grassroots could be to change the situation. But that requires massive organizing from the grassroots.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says hell is breaking loose in Lebanon. A massive escalation of the violence in that country. Again, civilian deaths in the several thousands already, and bombing of central Beirut, which the BBC's Jeremy Bowen observed. Israel says it's trying to return its citizens to their homes on the northern border with Lebanon. But Bowen says, the scale of what they are doing suggests more than that. The Israelis will argue very strongly that they're trying to defend themselves, but what their escalation has done is inflame the whole region.
Israel is out of control militarily, and the arrogance is just over the top. Very recently, from the UN, the top official, Guterres, was denied entry into Israel because of his statements of humanitarian concern for what Israel has been doing in Gaza. Rarely mentioned, it's sort of a footnote in a lot of U.S. media coverage, is that Hezbollah has been explicit that it has been shelling Israel because of what's going on in Gaza. And if Israel would stop its continued genocide program in Gaza, if Israel would actually adhere to a ceasefire, then Hezbollah would stop the shelling. Likewise, the Houthis, who've been from Yemen shelling ships in the Red Sea, they also have said, we're doing this in solidarity with the people being slaughtered by Israel in Gaza. Israel stops, and we will stop. Meanwhile, we have this sort of spectator role that Americans are encouraged to play as all of this goes on, as this tremendous suffering, this carnage continues in Gaza, in Lebanon, and elsewhere. And when I think of the generations, really, now that have been living under such terrible conditions, even before October 7th, 2023, in Gaza, I really recall the film The Zone of Interest and the ways in which it's so easy for us as human beings to turn our eyes, to pretend we just don't see. When the director of The Zone of Interest accepted an Oscar and spoke out just for 1 minute about how that human tendency that the film depicted of a Nazi commandant turning a blind eye to the extermination in a concentration camp, how that really has its echo in how we can be silent while Americans subsidize genocide in Gaza, the response was outraged and really, in a sense, proved his point. Within about 24 hours, more than 1,000, quote, Jewish creatives in Hollywood signed a letter that just went ballistic. How dare he say this? And in fact, I thought it was a very profoundly important one-minute statement, maybe one of the most important ever made from the Oscar stage in the history of the Academy Awards. We're so encouraged to numb ourselves, to stay asleep, to insulate ourselves from the humanity of others, even if, or especially if, our own government, in our names, with our tax dollars, are making the slaughter possible.
Thomas Pynchon, in his novel Gravity's Rainbow, says, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
Much of the media coverage of what's going on in Gaza simply asks questions that are evasive and avoids questions that would be to the point. When we think about the realities, how often have major media outlets questioned Secretary of State Antony Blinken or President Biden and said, how would you feel if your son or daughter was blown up courtesy of U.S. taxpayers? Why don't you insist that Israel stop bombing or all of the weapons will be cut off? These are basic, logical questions, but when they are avoided, then we're getting this sort of parody of journalism, which is more stenography than anything else.
Leonard Cohen, in his song Anthem, says, ring the bells that still can ring, forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Where do you see those openings?
Just because there are walls, it doesn't mean that there aren't cracks in the walls. And U.S. news media are certainly extremely powerful, but the cracks do exist in two important ways. One is that there are exceptional media reports in the mainstream, both in news and commentary, and we ought to encourage those, we ought to support those, and we ought to demand that authentic journalism replace the kind of stenography that usually exists for official power. And the other key element is supporting independent media outlets that don't hew to the line of the mainstream militarism, what Dr. King called the madness of militarism. Whether it's alternative radio or Common Dreams or The Intercept or other outlets, these are the lifelines we have to some sort of single standard of human rights and, dare I say it, sanity in a world that often seems sorely lacking in any semblance of sanity. So I think that's really important for us to be realistic, but not fatalistic.
Be realistic, but not fatalistic. The November 5th election, your thoughts?
It's not the election that we want. It's not the election that we deserve. I think when it comes to foreign policy, both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are militarists. They're dangerous. They have a double standard tattooed on their brains, so to speak. And the militarism, the ways in which they are so eager to inflict U.S. military power on the world at the risk of wider wars and even nuclear war, it's truly frightening and needs to be resisted. We need to call out either new president for what they are and organize against their militarism. When it comes to domestic policy, I think it's clear that there are huge differences between the two. And Donald Trump is fascistic, more so than in the last few years, as he has surrounded himself increasingly with people who have an extreme right-wing vision for what they want. They're anti-democratic, lowercase d, and they really don't want anything but corporate military rule while they make war on immigrants, on women, on civil liberties, on a minimal social safety net. And so I think that the choice should be clear as to what people can do. The reality is that we don't get to simply choose what the real options are. It's binary at this point. And so we have a choice to make.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David.
You were just listening to Norman Solomon on War and the Media. Norman Solomon is a political commentator and media critic. He's the author of many books. His latest is War Made Invisible. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Ilan Pape, Noam Chomsky, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Norman Solomon on War in the Media, and for his book, War Made Invisible, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is Ebony Spectrum. WRCT.org.
People standing, the kids that popped up that decided to visit us, we're so happy that you all are here. Everyone is welcome in this space. We are island people. If I had a chance, I would be grounding below a tree, but instead I'm here, right? And so everybody, just be as comfortable as you can. The turnout is just a reflection of the importance of this day. We're truly happy that you all are here. And so we're going to run into the program right away. to get things started and going. So I would like to invite the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, Dr. Ron Daniels, to give us some opening remarks and to tell us about the solemnity of the occasion. Dr. D.
Good afternoon, Grenada. Good afternoon, Grenada. My name is Dr. Ron Daniels. I'm president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And we have assembled a powerful delegation. All the delegation that have arrived. Raise your hands. Raise your hands. Raise your hands. These are people who have come from all over to be with you today. We are here on this location where the mother of Malcolm X, a warrior woman whose name is Louise Langdon Little. We're here to celebrate her on the eve of the 100th birthday of one of the greatest freedom fighters of all time, El Haj Malik El Shabazz Omawale, our black shiny prince, Malcolm X. We want to offer our thanks and our praise to Terrence Wilson. Where's Mr. Wilson? To Terrence Wilson. Yes, sir.
Of Dr. Garvey, who is actually the son of Marcus Garvey. Give him a round of applause for us, please. So as we celebrate the remarkable life of Louise Langdon Little, an activist and fighter, to pay tribute to another outstanding woman, a mother who lost her husband in the struggle in 1973, and 10 years later lost her son, the last revolutionary prime minister of Grenada, the woman who gave us Morris Bishop. I would like us to recognize Ali Menta Bishop, the mother of Morris Bishop. One of the shortcomings of us as black people is a failure to promote and protect our history. But were it not for one gentleman, a gentleman who has jealously guarded this property here, a gentleman who in his own right is a descendant of Louise Little and Malcolm X, and who over the years single-handedly has done everything he could to preserve that history of Louise Little. I remember when we came here for the first time with Dr. Daniels, we had a little trouble finding the place, and when we finally found it, we were at the bottom side, and we actually saw a sign saying no trespassing, but we took the liberty to trespass a little bit. And in no time at all, we saw this angry man come up and said, "Do you know that you are trespassing?" And when we explained to him who we were, and that this is Dr. Daniels from the Black World Institute, that anger just turned into love and togetherness. That gentleman has preserved this history right here. He has become the watchdog of the history of Louise Langdon Little. And he has defended the space in a way that nobody has, so that today all of us can come here to celebrate the groundbreaking ceremony for the monument that is going to be laid here for Louise Langdon Little. He will be the curator of this monument and also this project over the years. I have great pleasure in introducing to you Brother Terrence Wilson.
Pleasant greetings to everyone, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, ministers of government, and everyone, distinguished everybody. We are happy to be here because of this family project here. And we are most grateful for the International Black Wall, and all the other organizations who have stood behind us solidly to give us that support that can move this project forward with success. We also thank the government, our opposition, everyone for giving the support for what we are doing here. We have the t-shirt selling, trying to do little things. We are happy, and I must say, we are so happy. I don't want to spoil your time here. I want every one of you from the United States to have the opportunity to share with us and to dish out some historical food with us. So without any delay, we have the families here, bloodline families here. A lot of them are here, right up there. Then we have a Malcolm X Family Foundation, which we have in place. We have a manifesto and everything in support of what we are doing. So without further delay, I would just like to mention Sister Poland Patterson, Dr. Daniel, and everyone else who have been supporting us. We have Mr. Joel Redhead, Mr. Anthony Newell, and a few others who are members of the foundation who are here. Probably they might want to chime in and say a little word or two for a minute or so. And lastly, when I should finish saying what I'm saying here, the minister of the community here, Mr. Lennox Andrew, we would like you to come here and say a little something. Thank you very much. I don't want to waste your time. I want you to share with us and feel us with the knowledge that we don't know. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Wilson. Next, we are going to introduce Minister Lennox Andrews. He's the Minister of Economic Development, Planning, Agricultural Lands, Forestry, Economics, and Cooperatives. So can you please join us, Mr. Andrews, for some brief remarks? Thank you so much.
Very pleasant good day to all. I take this opportunity to welcome all of you from different parts of the world. Welcome to St. Andrews Southwest. St. Andrews Southwest that has produced some of the finest minds Grenada has produced, that has produced some of the finest Calypsonians that this country has, that has produced some of the finest athletes that this country has, that has produced some of the finest leaders that this country would have produced. This is indeed a moment of glory, a moment of happiness, a moment of achievement, a moment to rejuvenate and to make contemporary our years of youthful exploits. When, as children, we were growing up reading about the works of Malcolm X and of his mother. When as children we would listen to the speeches of Maurice Bishop and all the great African leaders like Patrice Lumumba, Julius Nyerere, Kwame Nkrumah, and all these great leaders who fought for freedom, fought for social justice, fought for a better world so that we can enjoy today. And so this occasion is an occasion that brings new life to those of us who for years would want to be in a position to fight for a better world and for a better place for our children and for our children to come. And today, we commemorate the memory of Malcolm X's mother. We commemorate the memory and we celebrate his 100th birthday tomorrow. And I want to say to you that we in the people of Southwest, we will take good care of whatever monument is placed here in his recognition. And I want to thank also my good friend Terrence Wilson, who has been with me and has been talking with me and talking to me and encouraging me to provide him with the support that he needs to make this day and to make this project a reality. And I want to say to Terrence and to his team that the government of Grenada and I personally will give you all the support that you need so that the memory and the work and the life of Miss Little and her son Malcolm would live forever and would motivate, animate, stimulate, and captivate, and his works can serve as an example, as a model for other young men and women to emulate and to follow. So those of you who come from far and wide, don't go back too soon. Spend some time and walk around. Get a sense of the Grenadian vibes. Get a sense of our spice. So when you leave with very fond memories of the history and of the work of this country. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Minister Andrews. At this time, I would like to call the Leader of the Opposition, Parliamentary Representative for St. Andrews Southeast, Honorable Emlyn Pear, to give a few remarks.
Thank you so very much, and let me join with those who went before me to especially recognize this morning a very huge and very special delegation visiting Grenada for such a special occasion and for a moment that we must all treasure and remember. So join with me again, as we did before, to specially welcome this delegation with us today here in Grenada. I am quite aware that you intend to carry back with you some of the soil from this very location. But I want to join this morning with the parliamentary representative for this area to say that while you are here, we would want you to have the very best experience of Grenada. Ensure that you are not just going back with a little bit of the soil, but you are going back with all the love that you can take with you of every single Grenadian who appreciates and who recognize the work, the life, the history of not just Malcolm X, great man, but also his dear mom. This commemoration today is extremely significant, and I do not believe that this is a moment that any single one of us should take for granted. I believe that when history would have been written and all of us would have gone very long past today, that we all would remember this very moment that we recognize a great woman. Brothers and sisters, with the time constraint this morning, I am not going to delve into all of the successes, the accomplishments, and all of the things that we are proud of as Black people, as we recognize not just Louis Little, but her son. But I want to just spend a moment this morning to recognize two things that I think is significant. As I look in the audience, we have so many women who are here with us today. And I'm sure most of the women who are here are also mothers. And I believe this is a very critical opportunity and a critical moment for every woman, every mother who is here this morning to reflect on what and who Louis Langdon Little was to Malcolm X. A strong woman who was extremely politically conscious, who was not afraid. A woman who would have provided inspiration to a son. If we go back to history, we would recognize that Malcolm X came from a home where it was not an ordinary home, a home of inspiration. And her relationship with Marcus Garvey and others, I believe, would have significantly inspired who he turned out to be. So I'm saying this morning to every woman who is here, every mother who is here, what are we going to take away this morning? What are we taking away from this very event this morning? I believe two critical things. One, it really doesn't matter where a woman comes from. Louis Little came from very humble beginnings. We are right here today. And many back then may have considered her someone who may not get very far in life just because of where she came from. And I say to us as women this morning, doesn't matter where we came from. All that matters is where we look to and where we intend to go. But not just where we intend to go, where we intend to take young men and boys. There's so many concerns throughout the world about young men and boys. But today I say, Louis Little is an inspiration to every mother in this audience. What inspiration will you provide to your son? Where will you take your son with you that could determine the rest of his life? And so as I close this morning, I want to specially recognize every single individual. There are so many persons who have been instrumental in making today what it is. I say hats off to you. Thank God for you. You are specially recognized. And may you continue to do everything that you can do in your capacity to recognize those who have gone before us and would have paved the way for what we enjoy today, the rights and freedom we enjoy, those who went before us. May God bless all of us. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you so much, Honorable Emlyn Pear. Today we also want to recognize the presence of the Ministry of Tourism, the Creative Economy, and Culture. We're going to have a few brief comments. We have the presence of the CCO, which is the Chief Cultural Officer, and the ACCO, and we'll have Mr. Kelvin Jacob, the Chief Cultural Officer, to brief us with some remarks.
Thank you, Ms. Patterson, and good afternoon, everyone. And I bring you greetings on behalf of the Ministry of Tourism, Creative Economy, and Culture. I stand on the protocol already established, welcoming all the dignitaries and visitors here, and all the locals from the community here as well, and the wider places in Grenada. What an honor it is for us to be standing today on sacred ground, where the home of Louis Langdon Little once stood. A place not just once of brick and timber, but of strength, dignity, and unwavering vision. As we gather to celebrate the 100th birthday of her son, Malcolm X, we do more than remember a man. We remember the roots that nourished him, the soil from which his courage and clarity was born. And those roots began right here with Louis Langdon Little. Louis was not merely Malcolm's mother. She was his first teacher, his first protector, and the one who planted in him the seeds of self-respect, black pride, and resistance to oppression. An immigrant from this land, Grenada, a writer of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and a fearless Garveyite, Louis stood tall in a world deemed to shrink her. This site is not just where a home once stood, it is where a movement began. In lullabies laced with liberation, in stories told by candlelight that reminded a young boy of his ancestry and his worth. The home is gone, but its spirit is not. The spirit lives on in each of us, and soon it will rise again in the form of a monument, a tribute not just to a mother of a giant, but to a giant in her own right. Let the future of this monument remind generations to come that behind every great movement, there are mothers, women, visionaries, and often unsung heroes who shape history from behind the curtains of survival. On this centennial of Malcolm X's birth, let us not only say his name, let us remember hers, Louise Landon Little. May her legacy be etched not just in stone, but in the hearts and actions of all who walk the path towards justice. I thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Jacob. At this time, I would like to invite the CEO of the Grenada Cultural Foundation, Mr. Livingston Nelson, to brief us with some quick remarks.
Greetings, everyone. I would like to stand on the protocol already established, but selfishly, please permit me to single out one individual who to me, I took a photo recently and I was so happy that I was able to have a photo with the son of Marcus Garvey. Yes, to me that is an honor. Sir, you are my hero. Let me just say that both Garvey and Malcolm meant so much to me in growing up, in learning my history and in trying to find my own self. And what they represent to me is a depart from the regular struggle. Not the march, not the demonstration, not the lectures, not the gathering, but a call to action. Are we focusing on Marcus and Malcolm call to action? Here, as we gather here today, what is our charge? So several times we are all there, we're marching and we're having several discussions and panels and lecture on black consciousness. Have we called our people to action? Are you encouraging your children to adopt an African name? Are you supporting the black business in your community? Are you lobbying with your politicians and your district board to ensure that the black agenda, that our children are endeared with what is our knowledge, what is our history, and respect for our elders? What is our charge? So personally, we have a responsibility to ensure that we live in the spirit of Malcolm and Marcus. And collectively, what is our charge? What do we tell our governments, our ministers? Are we trading with our neighbors, our Caribbean neighbors? Are we reaching out to Africa to form new alliances? Are we against the agenda? Are we focusing on the agenda that is given to us? Or do we seek and discuss and produce and develop our own agenda? What is the charge? So today I want us to depart, because if as a people for 300 years we have been doing the same thing, and again we have the same result, then we have to think differently. So I've been to several sessions like that, and I'm not hearing what is our charge as a people. I hear we praise ourselves. I hear we praise our personal accomplishments. What is our charge? What are we telling our young people? Are we naming the streets after our hero in Grenada? Are we having organizations and working alongside and collaborating with other such organizations that would build the black level of consciousness? I don't have all the answers here. But collectively, we have to think differently and act differently. We don't need permission from anybody else. We don't need funding from anybody else. We have it within our grasp. We have our own resources in order to channel a path that is different from how we were going for the last 300 years. I know I've said a lot, and I know we have a lot of other speakers, but I want to plant into our mind, just answer the question, what is our charge? Personally, what is your responsibility? Where do you shop? What do you buy? And then collectively, where do we trade? Which linkage do we bring? What is the result we want for our children in the next 200, next 500 years to come? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. At this time, I want to acknowledge a special young man. Throughout the activities that we have been having, we have stressed the importance of the intergenerational connection. What does that mean? The connection throughout generations, right? What is the linkage between the younger folks and our elders? It's very important. In the women's engagement last night, one of the young women asked, how do we foster relationships throughout generation? It was a very salient question with many answers. And today is an example of how we can do that. So we do have the presence of the Grenada Educational Development Foundation, GRENED, and Mr. Michael Mitchell, who is one of the leaders in charge. He could have spoken himself. But what did he do instead? He chose to offer the platform to someone younger, someone he'll be passing the baton to. And so I warmly welcome you, Mr. Wavell Dumont, to come and speak on behalf of the organization and to acknowledge the lovely young people that we have here today. Thank you.
Greetings to each and every one of you. My name is Wavell. Yes, my name is Wavell Dumont, representing the Grenada Education and Development Program. It is indeed a pleasure being here this afternoon with each and every one of you to celebrate this this wonderful ceremony. At GRENED, we have been supporting student education for 28 years, and these students have been engaged in leadership training. We support them through financial assistance, mentorship, and education. Hence the reason why we're here today. GRENED strives to build strong, modeled pillars of society in these students that the generation coming after will look up to them and follow in their paths and even accomplish even greater. So I want to invite these students to stand. They're across there to stand, and I want to recognize them here today. All right. Again, it's a pleasure being here, and we do thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah.
At this time, it's my distinct pleasure to invite New York State Senator, James Sanders Jr. On all the trips we have made to Grenada, and every time we have invited him, he has been here, he has been a presence. It's always a pleasure working with your office and your staff. So let's give him a warm welcome. He loves Grenada, and so we're so happy to have you here, Senator. Thank you.
To the children of Malcolm X, I salute you. To the children of Marcus Garvey, I salute you. To the children of Maurice Bishop, I salute you. I am reminded of that great philosopher, Luther Ingram. Luther Vandross, actually, who said that a house is not a home. Yes, it is true that the house of our sister Louise is gone, but Grenada will always be the home to Sister Little. It is true that our brother Malcolm X is gone, but he alerted us that every shut eye ain't sleep and every goodbye ain't gone. One of our previous speakers was speaking of the mother of a giant. And that is so accurate. It is also accurate to say that she was the giant of a mother. She was a woman forced under harsh circumstances to take her family and do the best that she could. The forces against her were enormous, especially in those days. Trying to be a black woman in one of the most racist parts of America at one of its most racist times, and raise children, healthy children, it's almost impossible to do it today. However, the seeds that were planted are good seeds. I'm looking at Grenada. It is so green here. I was told that if you just take a plant, a seed of any type, and throw it like that, you come back tomorrow and it's a tree. Well, I don't know about that, but I will